So many. I haven't done this much reading in a long time. Okay. Ajahn, is meditation compatible with competitive sports? When I play matches games, I want very much to win, although it's supposed to be for fun in a social setting. Does meditation help with competition? That's a trick question. I don't know. I guess like if you meditate, it sort of helps you win, right? Because you can be calm in the moment when you're playing sports. Yeah, I'm a bit of a... When I grew up, I was a bit of a sports fan. And just being able to be calm and collect yourself in the moment when you're playing sports, meditation can help you do that. So, in a sense, it gives you an edge over your opponent. But on the competition side, I think, you know, when you're competing, I think that's just natural when you're playing sports because there's always a winner and a loser. But if it gets to a point where you're competing and you're out there to, like, harm the other person and you're getting angry over it and things like that, then that's just pushing it too far. But, yeah. That's all I can say about that. Who plays sports? What are the meditation blankets for? Are they for warmth, modesty, psychological comfort? I think the blankets are there. If it gets a little bit cold, just use it. Wrap it around yourself. Modesty? I don't think so. This is the West. We're practicing in a Western setting, so... just growing up in Bodhinyana Monastery, you know, when it comes to just wearing clothes and things like that, we don't really say much about it. You know, just let people wear whatever they want to wear. Hopefully they're wise enough to wear the appropriate things when they go to a monastery, but or a meditation center. But, you know, when you go to places like, I remember going to Thailand to a monastery, and they had all these pictures on the wall saying what's appropriate to wear and what isn't. So you're not allowed to wear shorts, or you're not allowed to wear singlets and things like that. But that's in a setting like in Asia. But in the West, it's different. It's westernized in a sense. Psychological comfort. I'm not too sure. Sometimes you might feel cozy and warm when you wrap the blanket around you. So that might help you feel, you know, warm and fuzzy when you meditate. That's why we have these teddy bears here. If you feel lonely or sad, just pick one up. Hug it. Cry. Scream. I don't know. Do something that makes you feel good. All right. During meditation, I find it hard to know when I need to put in effort or just wait. And when I am watching my thoughts, I tend to go into them and attach onto them, then get lost in them. How can I let thoughts go? Okay, it's a good question. I think just being able to just learn from your experience, it's a very important thing. When it comes to the practice of meditation, when you think about it, just growing up as a monk living in the monastery, Ajahn Brahm would just give a talk from time to time. He's not there to hold our hands, to give us like personal instructions to tell us what to do. He just gives us a talk and he leaves us alone. And in a sense, we have to go away and figure it out ourselves. So with these teachings, it's pointing in a certain direction, pointing in the direction of peace, of calm, of stillness, of not having too many things in your mind. So you have something to give you a guide. You're not practicing blindly. You have something to work towards. And through your experience and through your practice, you can just start to see what's happening in your own mind. You can see the peace, you can see the thoughts, and you figure out a way to work with it. And it gets to a point where you start to understand, what is useful and what isn't useful. And the useful things, you just continue doing them and try to make them happen more in your mind. And the things that aren't working for you, then you sort of like know that it's actually harmful to me. So there's no point getting involved too much in them. And it's all a learning experience, I would say. And like I was saying today in the interviews, it's sort of like having a certain muscles in your mind. You know, we grow up in a society where we get taught to like develop the muscles of being analytical, going to school, developing the intellect. And that muscle in our mind is very strong. Or just the muscle of trying to be successful, putting in the hard work, chasing a career. You know, that muscle in our minds is very strong. So, and the other muscle that is very strong in our minds is the muscle of thinking. That is so strong. And when a muscle is so strong and it sort of like dominates the mind because you've been doing it for so long. And when something like that arises within the mind, it's very hard for you to slow it down or even let it go. So in a sense, when you're practicing this path of meditation, you're developing more peace, more calm, more stillness. And when you're starting off, that muscle in your mind is quite small. So you have to work at it. You have to make it grow. You have to put in the time so it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And it gets to the point where it's strong enough so you can use it to replace the other muscles in the mind. Say, if thinking comes up and that's a little bit strong, but because you've developed, so much calm, so much peace over the years coming here on meditation retreats, that muscle in our mind is strong. So it's very easy to use that to replace the thoughts which are troubling you. And yeah, it's sort of sometimes when you're developing this piece, it's like a place that you haven't been to before. And it's a place that can be discovered by each and every one of us, but it's covered up with obstacles in the way. And you meditate through the five hindrances, trying to get through ill will, through greed, through tiredness, through restlessness, through doubt. And at the end of that, there's a sense of peace, a sense of stillness. But we have to work our way through them before we get to it. But once we find out where that peace is, you know, where that stillness is, we know the way, in a sense. And we can just get back there. We can just get back there when we feel like it. So, yeah. Good. Ajahn, can you please tell us a bit more about yourself and why you became a monk? What is metta and how do we do metta meditation. Okay. So metta meditation is just this feeling of loving kindness that you have, that you can develop. You know, it's something that you can see, you can feel, and know, and it's quite easy to practice when you're trying to develop it with like other people. You know, that one-on-one connection with another human being, having a sense of like kindness, a sense of metta, like wishing them well towards them. And just being able to like communicate with somebody without judging them, communicating with people by saying, you know, the right words, by not putting them down and things like that. You know, that's like the metta, the beautiful qualities that we can have as human beings. And sometimes in life, you know, we meet people like this. People with just like they have a natural sense of metta, and they're just lovely people, yeah. And you can sense that they're not there to judge you, they're there to help if they can, and they're just like wonderful people to be around. You can just sit there and just hang out with them and just talk about anything and nothing, and in a sense, you get to see those kinds of examples in life. And maybe, you know, if you want to develop it, you can sort of like emulate it. But when it comes to the meditation practice, you know, metta is this ability to just to be, you know, be kind, yeah, to yourself. Is that, you know, feeling of, it's like an emotion. That feeling of, say, you know, love that you have, like, towards your parents or something like that. It's something that makes you feel good. It's something which is positive. And, you know, the Buddha would say that if you go to sleep with a mind of metta, you'll have a good night's sleep. And it's more or less, to me, it's more of an emotion that you can bring up in your meditation practice. And when you have it, it just makes things just that much more easier when you're practicing. And as people trying to teach metta meditation, we try to bring that feeling up. And some teachers would say, you know, you say to yourself, may I be well and happy. And you just pause and allow whatever, you know, emotions and feelings to arise. Or Ajahn Brahm would do something like, you know, he likes cats. So he'll do like a metta meditation towards, you know, cats. Yeah. So you just basically to get that feeling to come up of metta, not judging and accepting whatever is going on. And I like this is very powerful in the Metta Sutta when the Buddha said, like even as a mother protects her, you know, with her life, her child, her only child. And that's a very powerful saying, and I think a lot of parents can, or a lot of mothers, or even dads can relate to it. You know, whatever their child is like, whether they're smart, whether they're educated, whether they go to prison, whether they become a monk, a parent will always love their child, no matter what. And that's, you know, the Buddha is trying to point out, this is what metta means. It's just having a non-judgmental mind, a mind which doesn't want to harm anybody, and you take that into your meditation practice, and in a sense, if you're like watching the breath, you can use the breath as an object of meditation to keep your mind centered, and just wrap it around like the feeling of metta. It just makes it that much more easier to meditate. It adds something else different to the meditation practice. And if you can do it, it makes you feel really good. Yeah. Just like, yeah, it makes you feel really good. Okay. Can you tell us about a little bit more about yourself and why you became a monk? What do you want to know? Come on. I've been a monk for a long time, so I'm feeling kind of old sitting up here. I think it's been 16 years in monastic life. You do your first year as Anagarika. Have you seen Anagarikas before? They walk around in white. White, holy clothes, look more holier than us. So you do that you do that for a year, and you serve the monks. You drive Ajahn Brahm around. Like for the first time, you drive him around. You're really scared. I'm driving Ajahn Brahm around. Hopefully, I don't stuff up. But then, at the same time, you get to look after the monks. There's many opportunities to make good karma. When Jayaka was an Anagarika, I sort of instructed him how to make roast potatoes. And that gave him the opportunity to make a lot of good karma. Because the monks, they didn't leave any behind. They ate the whole thing. Because sometimes when we go to the temple, we bring food and, oh, the monks don't eat it. We feel so sad. Why didn't they eat it? And then we're like, oh, what's the point of going? They don't eat my food. But that's not the point. The reason why you go is for the intention. You want to give something to the monastics. And it's actually a great source of good karma. For yourself, whether the monks eat it or not. And sometimes I see it as, if the monks don't eat it, but you can share it with the people that go there as well. Like, and new friends that you can make, like-minded people. It's a lovely place to visit. You get the opportunity to, make a lot of good karma as an Anagarika, then I became a novice. For a year, and then I became a monk, and I've been doing it for 14 years. And people want to know, whoa, why did you become a monk? So I'm not a very serious person, so I always change the story. What do I usually say? Oh, I became a monk because my PlayStation broke. I became a monk because my mom kicked me out of the house. No, that's kind of serious. But I think that's one of the best things I did for my mother was to become a monk. Because now she knows I'm going to stay out of trouble. But anyways, weird things happen in life. Yeah? And just thinking back, on the path that I was on as before I became a monk, I can never imagine myself becoming one. But events happen in your life, troubles arise, and just stuff happens. And then my thinking changed. Like from being, I was doing my chef's apprenticeship before I decided to become a monk, and I had dreams of starting my own restaurant. Cooking really good food and all that kind of stuff, But but then things change for some reason. Well, I know the reason, but I'm not going to share it with you because it's very personal. But things change, right? And I wanted to find a way to to like sort of help myself as a human being. Because, you know, you have troubles. Even everybody has trouble. You know, if you don't have any troubles, you're basically not telling the truth. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll try this meditation. And the reason why I don't really know the reason why my mind turned in to that direction. But you know, it just happened. Maybe it's some sort of like karma in my past life that sort of directed me in that direction. And yeah, so I thought, okay, I'll try to fix my own problems by meditating. Yeah, I was like, oh, you know, I remember going to Dhammaloka. Ajahn Brahm would talk about how to live a good life and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to listen to this. I want to learn how to meditate. Why don't you give me a talk about meditation? And then I would go to the library and pick out some Buddhist books, and I would read it, and it would say, life is suffering. I'm like, that's not true. I'm not suffering. What is the Buddha talking about? So, you know, I had my doubts and my questions about Buddhism, but there was one thing that I was really keen on, and that was the practice of meditation. Because I knew somehow that in order to you know, do something about your problems, you have to fix yourself. So that's how I discovered, you know, the path of meditation. And from that point on, the focus in my life was just basically Buddhism and meditation. And I would go to Dhammaloka, I would listen to the Dhamma talks, I would lessen the amount of time I would work. And I thought to myself, oh, I don't want to work in kitchens anymore. You got to work long hours. The social scene is not healthy. People take a lot of drugs and they drink. So my mind just slowly just pulled away from that. And I started to focus more on the path of meditation. So I became a Buddhist when I was 21. And that's when I started meditating. And yeah, just to share with you just a few things as a beginner when I was meditating, I would just go, like, I would do a split shift, work in the morning, like go to work at 10, then you have a break at 3, and then you're back at 5, and then you work until, you know, 11 o'clock until it closes. So I would go home between 3 and 5. It was like focus on Buddhism, focus on meditation, keeping the 5 precepts, and not being drawn into taking drugs and stuff like that with my other workmates. I would meditate during that time. Yeah, just meditate. And I wouldn't get much from it. Because you've been working so many hours and the mind is really tired. So I would just sit anyway, just for the sake of it. And my mind wasn't ready to watch the breath. That's one of the first things I learned, was to watch the breath, but I couldn't do it. So I told myself, you know, this is like, because I'm not hard on myself, you know. So I told myself, it's not working for me. So what's the point of doing it? Why put yourself through more suffering than you already have? So instead, I just did present moment awareness, just being in the moment. And the body, you know, the mind was really tired. That's all I remember, just being exhausted. But when I came out of the meditation, you know, I felt refreshed. Yeah, there's like a benefit from just sitting there quietly for about half an hour. And being able to see the benefits of the meditation practice, that's what continued, you know, my interest and my efforts into the practice. Just seeing a little bit a benefit. Even though, you know, you're so learned in Buddhism now, right now, you know, all the defilements, restlessness, sloth and torpor, sleepiness and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that may bring you down because you can't live up to the words of the Buddha. That's how we've been raised, you know, a very competitive upbringing in the West, competing, you know, at an educational level. You always want to be able to live up to the people around you, to the words in the books. But sometimes you can't do that. It's just too hard. So instead, just look for the benefits that you may get, whatever it is, in the meditation practice. And then once you see the benefits, you'll just, okay, it's working. It's sort of working, but it's working. So you're like, just go back to it. And you just keep doing it. And just one thing led to another. So just 2 years, I wasn't really doing much. And then I told my mum I wanted to become a monk. And she was like, yeah, but she didn't believe me. And then I told my uncle. My mum told my uncle, he wants to become a monk. And he's like, yeah, he won't last. He'll be out in 2 weeks. So I just went in. Was it 23? I remember 23. I was going in there. I was very shy. I'm a very shy person, you know. So I was very shy. I was very shy when I was younger. So I was like, I went in there and I just didn't really know what was going on. So I went in there before the meal and I just helped out a little bit. And I think Ajahn Nisarano was the guest monk at the time. And I was like too scared to say anything. So I just sat out on the bench and I just waited and waited and waited. And then eventually he came out and he says, oh, you're very patient. You waited all this time. So then he took me to my room and just remembering those early days. I remember it was like, I think in October, and the weather was warming up. And yeah, it was kind of a freaky situation because it's new to me. First time being in a monastery, never visited the monastery before in terms of staying there. I went there on like a day trip to one of the big ceremonies. And it was just very simple, hardly any noise. And it's like for the first time I could hear the sounds of nature. And that's like, just like twisted my mind a little bit because I'm so used to, you know, being in the city, having the music on, you know, artificial sounds was my world for a very long time. And then just going into the monastery, having a different perspective, it's just a weird experience. So yeah, you know, and at the beginning, very difficult. I was missing my PlayStation. Oh, NBA Live. But then it's sort of like, then it's like you go into like survival mode when you're living in a monastery, trying to look for happiness wherever you can, and you know you make friends. That's what you do in a monastery. There's no TV, no clubs, nothing like that. So yeah, you got to sort of find ways, living in a different setting to find happiness, to keep you sane in a monastery. Yeah, there's a balance that we have to find when we're living there. It's not all about, sometimes some people want to become monks and they become scared. Oh, I have to give up everything. I can't read, I can't talk to anybody, I can't make friends. And they have that fear that it's going to be too hard. But just going into the monastery, I thought, okay, I was willing to live like I was in the military. So keeping the rules, no talking, and just do what I had to do to be able to fit in. And I was like, you know, that's not me, but I'll just do it because I wanted to be, you know, become a monk. And then I remember just at the meal time, and I think this is like one of the first times I saw Ajahn Brahm. And, you know, right now we have this rule in the monastery. I haven't been in a monastery for the past 8 months, but we have this rule in the monastery. When we go around the table, we don't talk. Because it's just disturbing, you know. We're monks, we don't talk. We've got to keep quiet. But that rule never gets kept. For some reason, over the years, that rule never gets kept. Like, people bring it up after the Paddy Mocha meeting, and Ajahn Brahm agrees to it. No one talks for a couple of days. And the first person that talks is Ajahn Brahm. So I was just sitting there, I was thinking, oh no, you know, monastic life is going to be so hard, I've got to keep all these rules, the monks are going to tell me what to do, I can't talk, can't do anything, it's like living in the prison. And then when I saw, like the first time I saw Ajahn Brahm, he was just like being playful, just joking around, just talking and, you know, having fun. And I thought, oh thank goodness we're allowed to act like this in the monastery. This is going to be a lot easier than I thought. So over the years, I discovered, from the outside, monastic life may seem very strict and very restricted, but at the same time, it's quite freeing, you know, freeing. We get a lot of freedom from you know, the abbot, and that's the way we've been trained, to just slowly do things, you know, make your friends, joke around, live a happy life as a monk. And yeah, so fast forward. Was it 14 years, like 16 years later? And I'm here. So yeah, 16 years later, so you just learn how, you learn, yeah, just 16 years later, you just keep on meditating. Same thing that you've been doing from day one until now. Practicing the same teachings, you know, making peace, being kind, being gentle. I'm saying the same thing over and over again. It may get boring, but you can start to see that it actually works. And what happens is the teachings may be the same, but the mind changes. The mind becomes more peaceful. The mind becomes more still. The mind, you know, it basically transforms into something else. And that's the wonderful thing. And that's the thing with Ajahn Brahm. He just teaches the same thing over and over again. But it, you know, it works. So now, now I'm living in Kelmscott. I might as well give that place a plug. I'm living in Kelmscott. It's called Dhanayana Ram. A monastery, but it's also known as a Cambodian temple because it was founded by Cambodian people, and they are the main supporters. There's a roster. They go there on a weekly basis to feed the monks, and I've been there, I think for the past 6 to 8 months. I think maybe 8 months. It's been a while now, and just trying to sort of like monasticize it and being more of a long-term presence in a place and trying to develop it so that people can understand that it's a place that they can visit to offer food to the monks, and also a place where they can go to learn a bit about Dhamma and meditation. At the moment we have Monday night meditation classes. So it's from, what was it, 7 to 8. You come in earlier if you want to have a cup of tea, chat with the people. And yeah, I do a bit of teaching and Jana Rato does a bit of teaching as well. We sort of like alternate. And at the moment, it's a small place and it needs to be developed. There's just like a house that they've done some work on. They built like a nice patio, But the monks are actually living in the house. I'm not living in the house. I live in a box, just out the back. But that's good enough. I'm just happy that I'm out of the house and have a little bit of privacy and seclusion. But the other two monks, like Janarata, he's doing it hard. He's living in the house. After so many years being pampered, living in the forest, in a hut, having all the privacy to yourself. So when you fart, no one hears it. You can fart as loud as you want. You can snore and no one's going to complain. But when you're living in the house, you just have to be mindful about how much sound you make or if you're disturbing the other person. And in the sense, it sort of like puts a little bit of stress on the monk. So my wish and hope is to move the monks out of the house, because it will be better. It will be better for them. But that being said, some of you know that the BSWA, they have purchased a property next door on Stocker Road, and it's a nice property. You should come visit. I shouldn't say much more about it. I should do you a deal. I'll tell you more about it if you come visit me. I'll tell you the full story. Okay, next question. Next question. So many questions. Okay, it's getting late. My bedtime. Your bedtime. Our bedtime. Stocker Road, lovely property. Canning River runs through it. Previous owners had dreams of building a facility for horses. So they built a, what is it called? A dressing arena? Yeah. And they built a stables. But they tried to put forward plans to build houses and have like a two or three families living on the property, and they couldn't get it passed with the council because the neighbours complained, or all the effluent from the horses will go into the river and contaminate the river. So they never, after many years battling with the council, they never got the approval, so they gave up on it. So the stables at the moment, it's run down, it's 15 years old, 15, 16, I don't know, 20 years old. But the good thing about it, horses never lived in there. So Ajahn Brahm saw it and said, "Oh, that's good enough for the monks." I'm like, "Thanks, Ajahn. Don't want to live with the horses, but because you're the Ajahn, yeah, we might have to live in there." So the plan is to renovate it. Yeah. So I'm going to be busting my back trying to renovate it. Ajahn Brahm says, "Oh, don't burn yourself out doing the work, but I don't mind doing the work, just a little bit, so I can contribute, and it's sort of nice to help out and try to save some money." Yeah, it's always good to save money, so you just do things yourself if you can. And so that's a plan in progress at the moment. And also, if you're interested in, I'm starting a, what is it? Like a half-day meditation. It's like 4 hours, just get together, keeping silence, a couple of talks, a couple of guided meditations, and just to give people opportunity to just practice in the afternoon. I think they put an ad, or they put something on the BSWA website. And yeah, now it's fully booked. So I'm thinking, this is my first one, see how it goes, if it goes well. They might just do another one on a more regular basis, because it's very easy to do. No need to organise any food or anything special. People just come along, just do a bit of teaching, and just, yeah, give people opportunity to get to know the place and learn some Dhamma, do some meditation. Okay. Any questions from the floor? More interaction is fun, you know. Everybody just sitting there quietly. No, nobody? Okay. Oh, too long. Oh, very long. Short one. Okay. Oh, very long. Okay, anyway, I shouldn't be like that. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings, what the Buddha teachings about energy. What are your beliefs about energy? How is it shared between people, etc.? Sometimes during strong meditation, I feel more energy expanding. Also, we project mental energy during meditation. I would love to hear your thoughts on this, please. Okay, yep. I was just thinking what I said earlier in the interviews. It sounded pretty good when I said it, but I can't remember what I said, so I'm not going to repeat it. It was really good, actually. But anyways, energy. Energy is, to me, energy when it comes to the meditation practice is being able to, you can see the benefits of energy, like the happiness, clarity of mind, being present, being with, you know, with the moment, with the people that you're with, and not having a mind which is foggy, yeah? You know, foggy mind which is just off with something. Daisy, huh? Off with the whatever. And you can just, sometimes you see people, and you can just tell that their minds are preoccupied, and they're always thinking about something. And that's, you could say that's a mind which is lacking energy. A mind which has energy is more, you know, more present, more with it, and understand what is going on in the moment. And you can equate that energy in terms of the meditation. When you're meditating, you can sort of feel like the energy is like bubbling up. It's like getting stronger because you've been still. Not like completely still, but still enough for the energy of the mind to arise. And sometimes, you know, when we're practicing meditation, one of the reasons why it's difficult is because we don't have that energy. And yeah. And you know, one thing that Ajahn Brahm talks about, he talks about, you know, like the beautiful breath. And as a teacher, when he gets you to the beautiful breath, then his work is done. Because after that, is basically automatic, because your mind is. And when he talks about the beauty in the breath, he talks about this quality called piti sukha. Like piti sukha, if you read the suttas, it talks about the different stages of the meditation. First of all, you have like the remorse is like disappeared. You become more virtuous. Your body calms down. I think thoughts come down, and then I can't really remember, but towards like the middle of the sequence, piti sukha starts to arise after like the tranquility of the body, and this is what Ajahn Brahm's talking about when he talks about the happiness of the mind, the beautiful breath, and the energy that you experience in your mind, and yeah. Is a place, yeah, and it's energy. It's like energy, you know, like it's powerful. It's, you could say it's powerful, you know. It makes you see things a lot more clearer. It makes it a lot easier for you to meditate, So yeah, this is the benefits of having like a good energy within the mind, having the piti sukha arise, or the beautiful breath, and it just makes meditation so much easier, and it brings a lot of happiness to your life. And you know, when you have happiness, you share it with other people. And you know, when you're grumpy, you just keep to yourself. That's how you sort of like deal with the world, and with the, you know, good energies that may arise, you know, from time to time. But energy is a wonderful thing, actually. It brings a lot of happiness, but it's something that you experience, and it's hard to describe. Yeah. Ajahn, thank you for a beautiful talk this morning. It was very inspiring. I always wondered why it was said that Buddhists are better meditators. Your explanation answered that question. When all the conditions for in place virtue with precepts calming the mind should come easily. Hope that is the answer. Yes, that is true. It's not all about meditation, coming to retreats and thinking that that's all you need to become a skilled meditator. Yeah. But also it's a threefold path. Virtue, being good, meditation and wisdom, like finding reasons to let go to free your mind. And Ajahn Chah gave a beautiful simile, one of my favorites. He compared the path of Buddhism to like a tripod. In order for a tripod to work, you need three legs. If one leg goes, if one leg's not there, tripod falls over. If two legs not there, tripod falls over. So in order for the tripod to work, you have to have three legs. And in the same way, when it comes to, developing the mind, when it comes to Buddhism, we need the threefold path. You can't do Buddhism with twofold path. You can't do Buddhism with onefold path. You need threefold path for it to work and to happen. Then, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Ajahn, can you explain one-pointedness in breath meditation? Thank you. Oh, okay. I think when I gave the guided meditation, was it early on this afternoon? And we sort of like transition onto the breath. And that gives you an understanding how the breath can arise. And basically is that one-pointedness is that experience where, the breath is like surrounded by silence or by peace or by quietness. That's all it is. Simple. Yeah. That's it. Long one. Okay. Thank you. Saturday Arvo session. Thank you for the guided mind-body scan, mind-body breath scan. It was fabulous. The breath has always been difficult for me, but I found bring my attention to abdomen helps, or breathing into whole body seems best. Yes. Usually I get tense if I focus breath on nose, neck, chest, etc. Do you have any other suggestions focusing the mind body scan I enjoy most? Okay. If the breath meditation becomes difficult, this is just another way of looking at it, and this is the way I've been, that I was practicing for a long time. Don't worry about the breath. Sometimes as a struggling meditator, when you go see Ajahn Brahm, great meditation master and all that kind of stuff, he would say, you tell him, oh, I can't watch the breath, Ajahn. What should I do? And he would just say, oh, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And over the recent years, he says that that's the most important attitude to have. When you can't do anything else, he said, it doesn't matter what meditation object you watch, or if you watch anything at all, the most important thing is making peace, being kind, being gentle. And if you're finding it difficult to watch the breath, don't watch it. Because I found it difficult as a young monk trying to watch the breath. I'm like, oh yeah, this is a lost cause. I can't do it. So for many years, I just present moment awareness, silence, and just making peace, being kind, being gentle. And what happens is that, builds up more space in the mind, more energy in the mind, more clarity. And then over the years, you start introducing the breath, and the breath becomes easy. And there's a whole bunch of things that happens, like I said before, being brainwashed, being reconditioned, that also helps you keep attention on the breath. But, it doesn't matter. There's a long path, not this lifetime, next lifetime. Lifetime after. Yeah. Cruise control all the way. All right. Any questions, comments? No? Sure? Here's your chance. No? Okay. Thank you, Ajahn. Bright smiley face. How many monks in the Kelmscott Monastery? What time we have? Oh, okay. So Dana, so they asked, what time does Dana start? What time can you feed the monks? Maybe I should let you know what I like so you can come and feed me. How's that sound? Ooh. Nah, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, it starts at 11 o'clock. So a little bit later than Bodhinyana. So it gives people time to let the stew cook for a little bit longer. So when you get it, it's nice and tender. Yeah, so I'm thinking of you guys, you know. So yeah. It's a very, the place is a very kind and friendly place. You don't go, you're missing out on something. Okay, anyways, how many monks are there? At the moment there's two monks, and we have another monk in Cambodia. He's like the original monk that's been staying there for the past 5 years. So at the moment he's living in the monastery that he trained in. He'll be back April 8th. So yeah, it'll be nice. We have three monks. More stomachs to feed, so bring more food. And at the moment we have Rob, who is Anagarika. So I'm trying to train him up to become a monk. So I don't know how I'm doing. He seems to be happy, so I must be doing the right thing. So he's there with us, and hopefully he'll stay on, ordain, at the end of the year. And at the moment we have Jan, who's from Germany, and he's going to be with us for about up until October. So it's a full house for us. There's no other rooms for people to stay in, unless you want to live outside, like with the kangaroos. We have fig trees there. I heard figs are really expensive, like $30 to $40. Yeah, but this season there's not so many because it's been dry. But anyways, you can come for the figs. Okay, next question. How do you deal with ego, yours and others? Other people's egos, you just don't need to get involved. They can, you know, it's their own karma. They do what they got to do. So, in a sense, like I said earlier, the Buddha said there's ways to deal with conflict. So you just give no attention to these people. And, yeah, don't need to get involved in drama, which is not yours. But in terms of your own ego, like I was saying to somebody today, when you practice meditation, when you find like a sense of worth within yourself, without the world or the five senses, you're not searching out, looking at things for happiness. You're not searching out, looking for people's approval for happiness or a sense of fulfillment, because you have something that you've developed inside. Like you don't need to be enlightened, you know. It's sort of like when you look at this path, it's not like you just cut things off and then you don't have your ego anymore. But it's, like I said before, it's like a slowly wearing away of something. So more contentment gets built up and the ego lessens. You don't need the praise from the world to feel good. You don't need to prove to anybody that you can do stuff. You know, some people are like, oh yeah, look, I did this. I'm such a great person. Like, you don't really need people to see you in that light when you have like a sense of like fulfillment within. And I think that's a way that I can see working to overcome, you know, that sense of self, that ego that you may try to overcome. But yeah. Simple, but it works, I think. Too simple? Maybe. Why are there teddy bears in the meditation room? I have no idea. You should have seen it before. There were like stacks of them. Yeah, it was like all over. Like, I think Ajahn Sujato sort of started it. Picked up the teddy bear and go, Teddy bear's so warm and fuzzy. He developed metta. It's all very nice and all that kind of stuff. So that's what he was doing. And people just kept on bringing teddy bears, just giving it to Ajahn Brahm. He would put it there, give it to Ajahn Brahm, put it there. And then before you know it, there was no rooms for the monks to sit down. Who's giving the talk tonight? Yeah. The teddy bear. I was trying to think of a teddy bear that's on TV, but I don't know of any. The teddy bear. So they've gotten rid of a lot of teddy bears. But I think that was the reason why Ajahn Sujato used it as a skillful means to like develop like the feeling of metta in one's meditation. How do you? Oh, I love these questions. How do you deal with pins and needles in sitting meditation? So, pins and needles. Like I said before, you don't need to be too hard on yourself when you practice. So, when you have pins and needles, just move your posture. Just relax your leg or whatever to get rid of the pins and needles. Or sometimes when you have, sometimes you don't know. You have pins and needles until you get up. And it's like, oh, I've got pins and needles. I can't do anything. So you've got to just move slowly, allow the blood to flow back, and then you can get up and just walk off. But, you know, if you're getting pins and needles or aches in the body, something's itching, some teachers tell you to try to persevere through it. But I've always, like, if I'm itchy, I just scratch. And then if my, you know, I'm sore, I'll just stretch. Or if I have pins and needles, I'll just move my leg, just to overcome that discomfort within the body. And what you find over the years is, at the beginning, when you start meditating, you're more like you're looking for distractions. So anything, a scratch on the shoulder. Oh, that feels good. Feels better than what I'm experiencing in my meditation. And then it's like, oh, so you just move a little bit. Because, you know, you're just looking for something to just do, you know, because this meditation is so new to you. But then after a while, when you become calm and when you become more peaceful and when you become used to sitting in the posture for, you know, not many hours, but you've been doing it for some time, the body doesn't disturb you as much as before. The itches aren't there. Oh, that's what I know. The itches, they're not there anymore. And the body is sort of like relaxed in that position. So you don't really get sore legs or sore back or sore anything. So you just allow them, in a sense, you're just allowing that your body to calm down. And to connect that with the suttas, the Buddha mentioned that as well. As you're practicing, one of the, like the stages that you get to is the body calming down. They call it like kaya pasadi, the tranquility of the body. And you just sit there, no pain, for a long time. Because yeah. I remember when I first started, my legs were like up like that and couldn't sit for that long, pain here, pain there, but now it's like easy to sit. Yeah. Sore back. I did my back in A, it was terrible. So glad in guided meditation at 6:30 that you advise us to drop breathing and instead focus on mind or body instead of getting tense trying to do a practice like breathing. Yes. Then kindness was a lovely reminder to focus on the positive instead of trying to solve problems with my mind, which I always mostly try to do and get tense. Can you tell me kindness? Yeah. Like, I was sometimes just trying to think about describing meditation to people, and like, it's the time for you to just be irresponsible. You have no job, have no gender, you have no name, have no responsibilities, nothing to solve. You're on holiday, basically, away from the family, away from your job. So what do you do on holiday? You just relax. Whatever happens, happens. And sort of like meditations like that, you're giving yourself a holiday from whatever you're doing, you know. Be, just allow your mind to just be, you know, for once, instead of trying to control it, manipulate it, trying to get jhanas, trying to become enlightened. So, time to just give yourself a break. And that's the wonderful thing about having contrast in your life. You can see the busyness and how that affects you. You can see, you know, the quietness, the times you take to give to yourself. You can start to see, you know, what is actually worth doing, what is beneficial for you. And just being able to give your mind a holiday is very beneficial. And that's what I love about being one of the things that I love about being a monastic is, yeah, you know, I'm kind of busy trying to set up a place, but at the same time, you have the afternoon to just have a holiday from all that. Just sit down and just chill, man. Yeah, chill. Okay. What's the point of meditating? I think I just covered that. Where am I going? How will I know I'm there? Where am I going? You're going nowhere. The more you want, the further away from the destination you are. How do you know when I'm there? You know when you're there. Trust me. I remember asking Ajahn Brahm, when you, I don't know how the conversation went, but I asked him about attainments and sort of, how do you know when you're there? And I don't know if I said it or he said it, but the answer that I got was, it's like getting a baseball bat and just hitting yourself over the head with it. You will know. You will know. That's something that I think I would say, but Ajahn Brahm could say something like that. I don't know. That's so long ago, but that's the point that we was making. You will know. Know without a doubt that, that you know, something is happening. Peace is there. Oh. And Ajahn Chah would say that too. You know, you practice to a point where there isn't any doubt. And that's when you know you've gotten to, you know, a true place of peace. Yeah. When there's no doubt in the mind. When there's no doubt in the mind, that's when you know. Because, you know, we doubt. Oh, is this peaceful? Mm-hmm. Should I talk to the teacher about it? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, is this nirvana? I really understand non-self. There's nobody here. But then you go, oh, I have to talk to the teacher about it. So there is doubt there. You don't really know. But if you know, then you know. Mm. Yeah, so you're not going anywhere when you're practicing. Beautiful, beautiful simile, Ajahn Chah one, is about the mango, the mango orchard. Ajahn Brahm talks about it all the time. It's one of my favorite ones. Basically, Ajahn Chah said, this monastery, the mango orchard, is built here by the Buddha. And, you know, the trees are full of fruit, full of, like, the stages of enlightenment. Stream enter, once returner, non-returner, arahat, jhanas, peace, stillness. The Buddha laid all that foundation down. And all you got to do is go find a tree and sit under it. And then the fruit will fall down by itself. It's wonderful. When I heard that, I was like, yes. It makes it so easy if you understand that to meditate. You don't have to try. You just sit down and just do nothing. And then when I heard that, I was like, yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, because it's a struggle sometimes. If you imagine it being a monk, year in, year out, trying to watch the breath, or year in, year out, trying to suppress the mind, that'll just drive you crazy. So it was a relief, actually, to know that you just need to sit under the mango tree, don't need to try too much, relax the mind, and, you know, the Ramayana will start to, like the pure mind will start to, like, reveal itself, and just things just roll and happen automatically. One of the beautiful things about this path is a natural path of practice, and I think that's one of the reasons why Ajahn Brahm is the way he is. He has like a hands-off approach to training his monks because he has this understanding that this path is a natural path. the speed of progress for everybody is different. But if you put in the causes, things will happen. So there's no need to force it. There's no need to try. You just let things happen naturally. And then, you know, it will come. Yeah, it's a nice thing, like, just being able to live in an environment where the teacher isn't controlling, because he understands that it's our own karma, our own intention, whether we want to make progress or not, and just leave it up to us. Yeah. Sometimes you go to places and they make you wake up really early, and you got to sit at this time and sit at that time. It's like, oh my gosh. It's like being in a prison. Okay, I'm always keeping to avoid my thoughts. Keeping by, I want to chant plus walk. Is this possible? To quiet my own thoughts? Yeah, you can walk and chant. It's just replacing another thing with replacing your thoughts with chanting. That's perfectly fine if the thoughts are too, you know, like too heavy or too strong, or like, when I look at thoughts, there's different degrees of thoughts. There's the ones that you can sort of like push aside, they're not a problem. And there's the other ones which, you know, just linger around a little bit, but then they disappear, you know, after a few minutes or maybe an hour or so. But there's a thought, then there's thoughts that just hang around with you for a very long time. They are like the heavy ones, the ones which are, you know, difficult to just brush aside, and you're trying to reason with those kinds of thoughts, but the reasoning doesn't work. You're trying to let it go, that doesn't work. Try to practice metta, all the Buddhist teachings, all in one go, blast those thoughts, but they still hang around. So you can't really do much about it. So sometimes, like chanting, can help, because it's more of a it's something which is, you know, more, you know, prominent in the mind, and you can replace something like that with the thoughts which is going on. And sometimes, yeah, I was telling somebody earlier on, sometimes when the meditation gets a bit too difficult, then sometimes you can't really overcome the problem, so you have to do something else, like. You had to find some sort of distraction. That's why, you know, sometimes it's good to go for a walk. Sometimes it's maybe do a few chores in your room, just to take your mind away, give yourself a break from that difficulty that you may experience in your meditation practice. And then once your mind has somewhat calmed down by doing other things, then you just go back to your practice. And you see, oh yeah, the mind is a little bit more calmer, so I can meditate now. I don't have those distracting thoughts anymore. But at the same time, with these thoughts, like I said before, the work that we do outside of our meditation practice is also very important. And sometimes these thoughts are there is because we cause them by the way we've been acting or the way we've been speaking. So we have to be careful with that as well. How are we acting? How are we speaking in our daily lives also affects what happens in our meditation practice. Okay, yep. Any questions, comments? Yeah, okay. Question, comments? Okay. Jenna, what are the different types of meditation? Online answers vary. Can you hear me? No. Huh? Oh, not loud enough. Oh, sorry. Huh? Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm mumbling, aren't I? I'm mumbling, sorry. Okay, I'm mumbling. I'm just like going through it quickly. Santini does things too quickly. Okay, online. What are the different types of meditation?
online answers vary? Do you personally find some more beneficial than others? What factors affect this? Thank you.
You know, when you become accustomed to meditation, you just try to keep it simple and just have a few meditation objects that you go back to, and not try to complicate things too much by trying this and trying that and then trying something else. But at the beginning, it's always good to experiment to see what works for you, and just keep it to like one or two things, and varying things up sort of like refreshes the mind. So we do a little bit of walking because that works for us. We do a bit of breath meditation, or, you know, just making peace, being kind, being gentle, being in the moment, that types of meditation, or even metta meditation. But it works for different people, you know, different strokes for different folks, really. And you just got to find out what works for you. And different teachers may resonate with you and some may not. So it's just really up to you to experiment and just see what works. And yeah, and just take it from there. But I think a good rule of thumb is to just keep it simple and just go back to the same objects just over and over again. Like I said, like meditation, the instructions always stay the same. What you do always stays the same. But over time, the mind changes. Yeah. Oh, last question. Any more questions? Getting late. Okay. In meditation, what do you do about earworms? Earworms, eyes. You know what an earworm is? I didn't know what an earworm was until today. You know what earworm is? So it's like a song that stuck in your head, and you can't really get rid of it. It's like an earworm, right? Yeah. Okay. Or tunes that won't stop in your head. Songs or tunes that won't stop in your head. I feel like my whole life, if I tune in, there's a soundtrack. I now use the earworms to stop me thinking. Sometimes it helps me focus on the breath, but they still are they still limiting me? Yeah, in a sense, it's sort of like a skillful means to distract yourself with something else so your mind doesn't really go too forward into the future, or too far back in the past, where, you know, when you go too far forward in the future, you start to proliferate, and your thoughts, you know, sort of like get out of control, and you start your own storyline, and just keeps them going on and on and on. And with thinking about the past, you're thinking about the past and thinking how it was, and if you could, you know, experience those things again, or the past was like this, so you just like dwell and dream about the past, sometimes wishing that you can have that experience again. But, you know, using these earworms, they may be music or whatever, to just take your focus away from those things. Yeah, in a sense, it can be helpful, but you're just replacing another problem. You're replacing a problem with another problem, really. Because it's not really leading to, like, a sense of stillness and a sense of peace. So instead, instead of try to use, but you know, if your mind is sort of like getting out of control, and if you think this is the only way to calm it down, then yeah, by all means, just do it until your mind calms down. And when it calms down, try to develop the Buddhist ways of keeping the mind stable, keeping the mind still. Yeah, like present moment awareness, you know, just like stillness, you know, just quietness. I think that's very nice. That's one thing that I like to get into, is just being quiet. Being quiet allows them to, you know, the energy, and being quiet is like the main ingredient for the energies of the mind to arise. And once the energy of the mind arises, it's, meditation becomes pleasant. It becomes, yeah, fun. I wouldn't say fun, because like, it becomes pleasant. Fun is like building something, you know. You like put up a wall with the other monk. You put up a wall or something like that. You're chatting with the monks. So he's like, yeah, we did a good job. That was fun, isn't it? Isn't it? You know, that is fun, but meditation is not like that. It's more pleasant. A pleasant abiding, like a nice place to be. Yeah, so that's what we're developing. And just stillness, quietness. It's a nice, I think, easy to, I don't know, for me it was like easy to understand and get, just to be in that stillness and quietness. And that's something that you can try to develop as a meditator as well. Okay. No more questions. Okay, anything else? No. Happy, sad, okay, doesn't really matter. Like I was saying before, you know, life is mainly neutral most of the time. Yeah, mainly neutral. You have ups and downs, but most of the time it's neutral. So when you have your highs, you share it with people. But when you have your downs, you avoid people. Okay. Yeah. Finished.